This is disc number 6.
I wanted to talk to her. I knew I'd been awful. Imagine, I kept telling myself, if you were Lara with a dead friend and a silent ex-boyfriend. But I only had room for one true want, and she was dead. And I wanted to know the how and why of it, and Lara couldn't tell me. And that was all that mattered. 45 days after. For weeks, the Colonel and I had relied on charity to support our cigarette habit. We'd gotten free or cheap packs from everyone from Molly Tan to the once crew-cutted Longwell Chase. It was as if people wanted to help and couldn't think of a better way. But by the end of February, we ran out of charity. Just as well, really. I never felt right taking people's gifts, because they did not know that we'd loaded the bullets and put the gun in her hand. So after our classes, Takumi drove us to Kusa We Cater to Your Spiritual Needs Liquors. That afternoon, Takumi and I had learned the disheartening results of our first major pre-calc test of the semester. Possibly because Alaska was no longer available to teach us pre-calc over a pile of McInedible French fries, and possibly because neither of us had really studied, we were both in danger of getting progress reports sent home.
"The thing is that I just don't find pre-calc very interesting," Takumi said matter-of-factly.
"It might be hard to explain that to the director of admissions at Harvard," the colonel responded.
"I don't know," I said. "I find it pretty compelling."
And we laughed, but the laughs drifted into a thick, pervasive silence, and I knew we were all thinking of her, dead and laughless, cold, no longer Alaska. The idea that Alaska didn't exist still stunned me every time I thought about it. She's rotting underground in Vine Station, Alabama, I thought, but even that wasn't quite it. Her body was there, but she was nowhere. Nothing. Poof. The times that were the most fun seemed always to be followed by sadness now, because it was when life started to feel like it did when she was with us that we realized how utterly, totally gone she was. I bought the cigarettes. I'd never entered Kusa Liquors, but it was every bit as desolate as Alaska described. The dusty wooden floor creaked as I made my way to the counter, and I saw a large barrel filled with brackish water that purported to contain live bait, but in fact contained a veritable school of dead, floating minnows. The woman behind the counter smiled at me with all four of her teeth when I asked her for a carton of Marlboro Lights.
"You go to Culver Creek?"
she asked me, and I did not know whether to respond truthfully, since no high school student was likely to be 19, but she grabbed the carton of cigarettes from beneath her and put it on the counter without asking for an ID, so I said, "Yes, ma'am."
"How's school?"
she asked.
"Pretty good," I answered.
"Heard y'all had a death up there."
"Yes'm," I say.
"I's awful sorry to hear it."
"Yes'm." The woman, whose name I did not know because this was not the sort of commercial establishment to waste money on name tags, had one long white hair growing from a mole on her left cheek. It wasn't disgusting exactly, but I couldn't stop glancing at it and then looking away. Back in the car, I handed a pack of cigarettes to the colonel. We rolled down the windows, although the February cold bit at my face and the loud wind made conversation impossible. I sat in my quarter of the car and smoked, wondering why the old woman at Kusa Liquors didn't just pull that one hair out of her mole. The wind blew through Takumi's rolled-down window in front of me and against my face. I scooted to the middle of the back seat and looked up at the colonel sitting shotgun, smiling, his face turned to the wind blowing in through his window. 46 days after. I didn't want to talk to Lara, but the next day at lunch, Takumi pulled the ultimate guilt trip.
"How do you think Alaska would feel about this shit?"
he asked as he stared across the cafeteria at Lara. She was sitting three tables away from us with her roommate, Katie, who was telling some story, and Lara smiled whenever Katie laughed at one of her own jokes. Lara scooped up a forkful of canned corn and held it above her plate, moving her mouth to it and bowing her head toward her lap as she took the bite from the fork, a quiet eater.
"She could talk to me," I told Takumi.
Takumi shook his head. His open mouth gooey with mashed potatoes, he said,
Yahatho.
He swallowed.
Let me ask you a question, Pudge. When you're old and gray, and your grandchildren are sitting on your knee and look up at you and say, Grandpappy, who gave you your first blowjob? Do you want to have to tell them it was some girl you spent the rest of high school ignoring?
No.
He smiled.
You want to say, my dear friend Lara Buterskaya, lovely girl, prettier than your grandma by a wide margin.
I laughed. So, yeah, okay. I had to talk to Lara. After classes, I walked over to Lara's room and knocked.
And then she stood in the doorway looking like, what? What now? You've done the damage you could, Pudge.
And I looked past her into the room I'd only entered once, where I learned that, kissing or no, I couldn't talk to her. And before the silence could get too uncomfortable, I talked.
I'm sorry, I said.
For what?
She asked, still looking toward me but not quite at me. For ignoring you, for everything, I said.
You didn't have to be my boyfriend.
She looked so pretty, her big eyes blinking fast, her cheeks soft and round, and still, the roundness could only remind me of Alaska's thin face and her high cheekbones. But I could live with it, and anyway, I had to.
You could have just been my friend, she said.
I know. I screwed up. I'm sorry.
Don't forgive that asshole, Katie cried from inside the room.
I forgive you.
Lara smiled and hugged me, her hands tight around the small of my back. I wrapped my arms around her shoulders and smelled violets in her hair.
I don't forgive you, Katie said, appearing in the doorway.
And although Katie and I were not well acquainted, she felt comfortable enough to knee me in the balls. She smiled then, and as I crumpled into a bow, Katie said,
Now I forgive you.
Lara and I took a walk to the lake, sans Katie, and we talked. We talked about Alaska and about the past month, about how she had to miss me and miss Alaska while I only had to miss Alaska, which was true enough. I told her as much of the truth as I could, from the firecrackers to the Pelham Police Department and the white tulips. I loved her, I said, and Lara said she loved her too. And I said,
I know, but that's why.
I loved her, and after she died, I couldn't think about anything else. It felt like dishonest, like cheating.
That's not a good reason, she said.
I know, I answered. She laughed softly.
Well, good then, as long as you know.
I knew I wasn't going to erase that anger, but we were talking. As darkness spread that evening, the frogs croaked, and a few newly resurrected insects buzzed about campus. And the four of us, Takumi, Lara, the Colonel, and I, walked through the cold gray light of a full moon to the smoking hole.
Hey, Colonel, why do you call it the smoking hole?
Lara asked. It's like a tunnel.
It's like a fishing hole, the Colonel said. Like, if we fished, we'd fish here. But we smoke. I don't know, I think Alaska named it.
The Colonel pulled a cigarette out of his pack and threw it into the water.
What the hell? I asked.
For her, he said. I half smiled and followed his lead, throwing in a cigarette of my own. I handed Takumi and Lara cigarettes, and they followed suit. The smokes bounced and danced in the stream for a few moments, and then they floated out of sight. I was not religious, but I liked rituals. I liked the idea of connecting an action with remembering. In China, the old man had told us, there are days reserved for grave cleaning, where you make gifts to the dead, and I imagined that Alaska would want to smoke. And so it seemed to me that the Colonel had begun an excellent ritual. The Colonel spit into the stream and broke the silence.
Funny thing, talking to ghosts, he said. You can't tell if you're making up their answers, or if they're really talking to you.
I say we make a list,
Takumi said, steering clear of introspective talk.
What kind of proof do we have of suicide?
The Colonel pulled out his omnipresent notebook. She never hit the brakes, I said, and the Colonel started scribbling. And she was awfully upset about something, although she'd been awfully upset without committing suicide many times before. We considered that maybe the flowers were some kind of memorial to herself, like a funeral arrangement or something. But that didn't seem very Alaskan to us. She was cryptic, sure, But if you're going to plan your suicide down to the flowers, you probably have a plan as to how you're actually going to die. And Alaska had no way of knowing a police car was going to present itself on I-65 for the occasion. And the evidence suggesting an accident?
She was really drunk, so she could have thought she wasn't going to hit the cop, although I don't know how,
Takumi said.
She could have fallen asleep,
Lara offered.
Yeah, we've thought about that, I said, but I don't think you keep driving straight if you fall asleep.
I can't think of a way to find out that does not put our lives in considerable danger, the colonel deadpanned. Anyway, she didn't show warning signs of suicide. I mean, she didn't talk about wanting to die or give away her stuff or anything.
That's two. Drunk and no plans to die,
Takumi said. This wasn't going anywhere. Just a different dance with the same question. What we needed wasn't more thinking. We needed more evidence.
We have to find out where she was going, the colonel said.
The last people she talked to were me, you, and Jake, I said to him. And we don't know. So how the hell are we going to find out? Takumi looked over at the colonel and sighed.
I don't think it would help to know where she was going. I think that would make it worse for us. Just a gut feeling.
Well, my gut wants to know, Lara said, and only then did I realize what Takumi meant the day we'd showered together. I may have kissed her, but I really didn't have a monopoly on Alaska.
The colonel and I weren't the only ones who cared about her, and weren't alone in trying to figure out how she died and why.
Well, regardless, said the colonel, we're at a dead end. So one of you think of something to do, because I'm out of investigative tools.
He flicked his cigarette butt into the creek, stood up, and left. We followed him. Even in defeat, he was still the colonel. 51 days after. The investigation stalled, I took to reading for religion class again, which seemed to please the old man, whose pop quizzes I'd been failing consistently for a solid 6 weeks. We had one that Wednesday morning. Share an example of a Buddhist koan. A koan is like a riddle that's supposed to help you toward enlightenment in Zen Buddhism. From my answer, I wrote about this guy, Banzan. He was walking through the market one day when he overheard someone ask a butcher for his best piece of meat. The butcher answered, "Everything in my shop is the best. You cannot find a piece of meat that is not the best." Upon hearing this, Banzan realized that there is no best and no worst, that those judgments have no real meaning, because there is only what is, and poof, he reached enlightenment. Reading it the night before, I'd wondered if it would be like that for me, if in one moment I would finally understand her, know her, and understand the role I'd played in her dying. But I wasn't convinced enlightenment struck like lightning. After we'd passed our quizzes, the old man, sitting, grabbed his cane and motioned toward Alaska's fading question on the blackboard.
"Let's look at one sentence on page 94 of this very entertaining introduction to Zen that I had you read this week. Everything that comes together falls apart," the old man said. "Everything. The chair I'm sitting on. It was built, and so it will fall apart. I'm going to fall apart probably before this chair. And you're going to fall apart. The cells and organs and systems that make you, you, they came together, grew together, and so must fall apart. The Buddha knew one thing science didn't prove for millennia after his death. Entropy increases. Things fall apart."
We are all going, I thought. And it applies to turtles and turtlenecks, Alaska the girl and Alaska the place, because nothing can last, not even the earth itself. The Buddha said that suffering was caused by desire, we'd learned, and that the cessation of desire meant the cessation of suffering. When you stopped wishing things wouldn't fall apart, you'd stop suffering when they did. Someday, no one will remember that she ever existed, I wrote in my notebook, and then, or that I did. Because memories fall apart, too, and then you're left with nothing, left not even with a ghost, but with its shadow. In the beginning, she had haunted me, haunted my dreams, but even now, just weeks later, she was slipping away,
falling apart in my memory and everyone else's, dying again.
The colonel, who had driven the investigation from the start, who had cared about what happened to her when I only cared if she loved me, had given up on it, answerless. And I didn't like what answers I had. She hadn't even cared enough about what happened between us to tell Jake. Instead, she had just talked cute with him, giving him no reason to think that minutes before I'd tasted her boozy breath. And then something invisible snapped inside her, and that which had come together commenced to fall apart. And maybe that was the only answer we'd ever have. She fell apart because that's what happens. The colonel seemed resigned to that, but if the investigation had once been his idea, it was now the thing that held me together, and I still hoped for enlightenment. 62 days after. The next Sunday, I slept in until the late morning sunlight slivered through the blinds and found its way to my face. I pulled the comforter over my head, but the air got hot and stale, so I got up to call my parents.
"Miles," my mom said before I even said hello, "we just got caller identification."
"Does it magically know it's me calling from the payphone?" She laughed.
"No, it just says payphone in the area code, so I deduced." "How are you?"
she asked, a warm concern in her voice.
"I'm doing okay. I kind of screwed up some of my classes for a while, but I'm back to studying now, so it should be fine," I said, and that was mostly true.
"I know it's been hard on you, buddy," she said.
"Oh, guess who your dad and I saw at a party last night? Mrs. Forrester, your fourth grade teacher, remember? She remembered you perfectly and spoke very highly of you, and we just talked." And while I was pleased to know that Mrs. Forrester held my fourth grade self in high regard, I only half listened as I read the scribbled notes on the white-painted pine wall on either side of the phone, looking for any new ones I might be able to decode.
"Lacey's, Friday, 10, were the when and where of a weekday warrior party, I figured.
"And we had lunch with the Johnstons last night, and I'm afraid that Dad had too much wine. We played charades, and he was just awful."
She laughed, and I felt so tired, but someone had dragged the bench away from the payphone, so I sat my bony butt down on the hard concrete, pulling the silver cord of the phone taut and preparing for a serious soliloquy from my mom. And then, down below all the other notes and scribbles, I saw a drawing of a flower. 12 oblong petals around a filled-in circle against the daisy-white paint. And daisies, white daisies. And I could hear her saying, "What do you see, Pudge? Look." And I could see her sitting drunk on the phone with Jake, talking about nothing, and, "What are you doing?" And she says, "Nothing. Just doodling. Just doodling." And then, oh God.
"Miles?"
"Yeah. Sorry, Mom. Sorry. Chip's here. We gotta go study. I gotta go.
Will you call us later, then? I'm sure Dad wants to talk to you."
"Yeah, Mom. Yeah, of course. I love you, okay? Okay, I gotta go."
"I think I found something," I shouted at the colonel, invisible beneath his blanket, but the urgency in my voice and the promise of something, anything, found, woke the colonel up instantly, and he jumped from his bunk to the linoleum.
Before I could say anything, he grabbed yesterday's jeans and sweatshirt from the floor, pulled them on, and followed me outside.
"Look," I pointed, and he squatted down beside the phone and said,
"Yeah, she drew that. She was always doodling those flowers."
"And just doodling, remember? Jake asked her what she was doing, and she said, 'Just doodling,' and then she said, 'Oh God,' and freaked out. She looked at the doodle and remembered something."
"Good memory, Pudge," he acknowledged,
and I wondered why the colonel wouldn't just get excited about it. "And then she freaked out," I repeated, "and went and got the tulips while we were getting the fireworks. She saw the doodle, remembered whatever she'd forgotten, and then freaked out."
"Maybe," he said, still staring at the flower, trying perhaps to see it as she had. He stood up finally and said, "It's a solid theory, Pudge," and reached up and patted my shoulder, like a coach complimenting a player. "But we still don't know what she forgot."
69 days after. A week after the discovery of the doodled flower, I'd resigned myself to its insignificance. I wasn't Ban Zan in the meat market after all. And as the maples around campus began to hint of resurrection and the maintenance crew began mowing the grass in the dorm circle again,
It seemed to me we had finally lost her. The colonel and I walked into the woods down by the lake that afternoon and smoked a cigarette in the precise spot where the eagle had caught us so many months before. We'd just come from a town meeting where the eagle announced that the school was going to build a playground by the lake in memory of Alaska. She did like swings, I guess, but a playground? Lara stood up at the meeting, surely a first for her, and said they should do something funnier, something Alaska herself would have done. Now, by the lake, sitting on a mossy, half-rotten log, the colonel said to me, "Lara was right. We should do something for her. A prank, something she would have loved."
"Like a memorial prank?"
"Exactly. The Alaska Young Memorial Prank. We can make it an annual event." Anyway, she came up with this idea last year, but she wanted to save it to be our senior prank. But it's good. It's really good. It's historic. "Are you going to tell me?" I asked, thinking back to the time when he and Alaska had left me out of prank planning for barn night. "Sure," he said. "The prank is entitled Subverting the Patriarchal Paradigm." And he told me. And I have to say, Alaska left us with the crown jewel of pranks, the Mona Lisa of high school hilarity, the culmination of generations of Culver Creek pranking. And if the colonel could pull it off, it would be etched in the memory of everyone at the creek, and Alaska deserved nothing less. Best of all, it did not technically involve any expellable offenses. The colonel got up and dusted the dirt and moss off his pants.
"I think we owe her that."
And I agreed, but still, she owed us an explanation. If she was up there, down there, out there, somewhere, maybe she would laugh. And maybe, just maybe, she would give us the clue we needed. 83 days after. 2 weeks later, the colonel returned from spring break with two notebooks filled with the minutiae of prank planning, sketches of various locations, and a 40-page, two-column list of problems that might crop up and their solutions. He calculated all times to a tenth of a second and all distances to the inch, and then he recalculated as if he could not bear the thought of failing her again. And then, on that Sunday, the colonel woke up late and rolled over. I was reading The Sound and the Fury, which I was supposed to have read in mid-February, and I looked up as I heard the rustling in the bed, and the colonel said, "Let's get the band back together." And so I ventured out into the overcast spring and woke up Lara and Takumi and brought them back to room 43. The barn night crew was intact, or as close as it ever would be, for the Alaska Young Memorial prank. The three of us sat on the couch while the colonel stood in front of us, outlining the plan and our parts in it, with an excitement I hadn't seen in him since before. When he finished, he asked, "Any questions?"
"Yeah," Takumi said. "Is that seriously gonna work?"
"Well, first we gotta find a stripper, and second, Pudge has to work some magic with his dad."
"All right then," Takumi said. "Let's get to work."
84 days after. Every spring, Culver Creek took one Friday afternoon off from classes, and all the students, faculty, and staff were required to go to the gym for Speaker Day. Speaker Day featured two speakers, usually small-time celebrities or small-time politicians or small-time academics, the kind of people who would come and speak at a school for the measly $300 the school budgeted. The junior class picked the first speaker, and the seniors the second. And anyone who had ever attended a speaker day agreed that they were torturously boring. We planned to shake speaker day up a bit. All we needed to do was to convince the eagle to let Dr. William Morse, a friend of my dad's and a preeminent scholar of deviant sexuality in adolescence, be the junior class's speaker. So I called my dad at work, and his secretary, Paul, asked me if everything was all right, and I wondered why everyone asked me if everything was all right when I called at any time other than Sunday morning. "Yeah, I'm fine." My dad picked up. "Hey, Miles, is everything all right?" I laughed and spoke quietly into the phone, since people were milling about.
"Yeah, Dad, everything is fine. Hey, remember when you stole the school bell and buried it in the cemetery?"
"Greatest Culver Creek prank ever," he responded proudly.
"It was, Dad. It was. So, listen,
I wonder if you'd help out with the new greatest Culver Creek prank ever.
Oh, I don't know about that, Miles. I don't want you getting in any trouble.
Well, I won't. The whole junior class is planning it, and it's not like anyone is going to get hurt or anything, because, well, remember Speaker Day?
God, that was boring. That was almost worse than class.
Yeah, well, I need you to pretend to be our speaker, Dr. William Morse, a professor of psychology at the University of Central Florida and an expert in adolescent understandings of sexuality. He was quiet for a long time, and I looked down at Alaska's last daisy and waited for him to ask what the prank was, and I would have told him, but I just heard him breathe slowly into the phone, and then he said,
I won't even ask. Hmm, he sighed. Swear to God you'll never tell your mother.
I swear to God. I paused. It took me a second to remember the eagle's real name. Mr. Starnes is going to call you in about 10 minutes.
Okay, my name is Dr. William Morse, and I'm a psychology professor and...
adolescent sexuality?
Yep, you're the best, Dad. I just want to see if you can top me, he said, laughing.
Although it killed the colonel to do it, the prank could not work without the assistance of the weekday warriors, specifically junior class president Longwell Chase, who by now had grown his silly surfer mop back. But the warriors loved the idea, so I met Longwell in his room and said, let's go. Longwell Chase and I had nothing to talk about and no desire to pretend otherwise, so we walked silently to the eagle's house. The eagle came to the door before we even knocked. He cocked his head a little when he saw us, looking confused, and indeed we made an odd couple, with Longwell's pressed and pleated khaki pants, and my I-keep-meaning-to-do-the-laundry blue jeans.
The speaker we picked is a friend of Miles's dad, Longwell said, Dr. William Morse. He's a professor at a university down in Florida, and he studies adolescent sexuality.
Aiming for controversy, are we?
Oh, no, I said. I've met Dr. Morse. He's interesting, but he's not controversial. He just studies the way that adolescents' understanding of sex is still changing and growing. I mean, he's opposed to premarital sex.
Well, what's his phone number?
I gave the eagle a piece of paper, and he walked to a phone on the wall and dialed.
Yes, hello, I'm calling to speak with Dr. Morse.
Okay, thanks.
Hello, Dr. Morse. I have Miles Halter here in my home, and he tells me...
Great. Wonderful.
Well, I was wondering...
The eagle paused, twisting the cord around his finger.
Wondering, I guess, whether you...
Just so long as you understand that these are impressionable young people, we wouldn't want explicit discussions.
Excellent. Excellent. I'm glad you understand.
You too, sir. See you soon.
The eagle hung up the phone, smiling, and said,
Good choice. He seems like a very interesting man.
Oh, yeah, Longwell said very seriously. I think he will be extraordinarily interesting.
102 days after. My father played Dr. William Morse on the phone, but the man playing him in real life went by the name of Max with two X's, except that his name was actually Stan. Except on Speaker Day, his name was obviously Dr. William Morse. He was a veritable existential identity crisis, a male stripper with more aliases than a covert CIA agent. The first four agencies the colonel called turned us down. It wasn't until we got to the B's in the entertainment section of the Yellow Pages that we found Bachelorette Parties Are Us. The owner of the aforementioned establishment liked the idea a great deal, but he said, Max is going to love that, but no nudity, not in front of the kids. We agreed, with some reluctance. To ensure that none of us would get expelled, Takumi and I collected $5 from every junior at Culver Creek to cover Dr. William Morse's appearance fee, since we doubted the eagle would be keen on paying him after witnessing the, speech. I paid the colonel's $5.
I feel that I have earned your charity, he said, gesturing to the spiral notebooks he'd filled with plans.
As I sat through my classes that morning, I could think of nothing else. Every junior in the school had known for 2 weeks, and so far not even the faintest rumor had leaked out. But the creek was rife with gossips, particularly the weekday warriors, and if just one person told one friend who told one friend who told one friend who told the eagle, everything would fall apart. The Creek's don't-rat ethos withstood the test nicely, but when Max Stan Dr. Morse didn't show up by 11:50 that morning, I thought the colonel would lose his shit. He sat on the bumper of a car in the student parking lot, his head bowed, his hands running through his thick mop of dark hair over and over again, as if he were trying to find something in there. Max had promised to arrive by 11:40, 20 minutes before the official start of Speaker Day, giving him time to learn the speech and everything. I stood next to the colonel, worried but quiet, waiting. We'd sent Takumi to call the agency and learn the whereabouts of the performer.
Of all the things I thought could go wrong, this was not one of them. We have no solution for this.
Takumi ran up, careful not to speak to us until he was near. Kids were starting to file into the gym. Late, 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 late. We asked so little of our performer, really. We had written his speech. We had planned everything for him. All Max had to do was show up with his outfit on, and yet...
The agency, said Takumi, says the performer is on his way.
On his way? The colonel said, clawing at his hair with a new vigor. On his way? He's already late.
They said he should be...
And then suddenly our worries disappeared as a blue minivan rounded the corner toward the parking lot, and I saw a man inside wearing a suit.
That'd better be Max, the colonel said as the car parked.
He jogged up to the front door.
I'm Max, the guy said upon opening the door. I am a nameless and faceless representative of the junior class, the colonel answered, shaking Max's hand.
He was 30-ish, tan, and wide-shouldered, with a strong jaw and a dark, close-cropped goatee. We gave Max a copy of his speech, and he read through it quickly.
Any questions? I asked.
Yeah, given the nature of this event, I think y'all should pay me in advance.
He struck me as very articulate, even professorial, and I felt a supreme confidence, as if Alaska had found the best male stripper in central Alabama and led us right to him. Takumi popped the trunk of his SUV and grabbed a paper grocery bag with $320 in it.
Here you go, Max, he said. Okay, Pudge here is going to sit down there with you, because you are friends with Pudge's dad. That's in the speech. But we're hoping that if you get interrogated when this is all over, you can find it in your heart to say that the whole junior class called on a conference call to hire you, because we wouldn't want Pudge here to get in any trouble.
He laughed.
Sounds good to me. I took this gig because I thought it was hilarious. Wish I'd thought of this in high school.
As I walked into the gym, Max, Dr. William Morse at my side, Takumi and the colonel trailing a good bit behind me, I knew I was more likely to get busted than anyone else. But I'd been reading the Culver Creek Handbook pretty closely the last couple weeks, and I reminded myself of my two-pronged defense in the event I got in trouble. One, there is not technically a rule against paying a stripper to dance in front of the school. Two, it cannot be proven that I was responsible for the incident. It can only be proven that I brought a person onto campus who I presumed to be an expert on sexual deviancy in adolescence and who turned out to be an actual sexual deviant. I sat down with Dr. William Morse in the middle of the front row of bleachers. Some ninth graders sat behind me, but when the colonel walked up with Laura a moment later, he politely told them, "Thanks for holding our seats," and ushered them away. As per the plan, Takumi was in the supply room on the second floor, connecting his stereo equipment to the gym's loudspeakers. I turned to Dr. Morse and said, "We should look at each other with great interest and talk like you're friends with my parents." He smiled and nodded his head.
"He is a great man, your father, and your mother so beautiful."
I rolled my eyes, a bit disgusted. Still, I liked this stripper fellow. The Eagle came in at noon on the nose, greeted the senior class speaker, a former Alabama state attorney general, and then came over to Dr. Morse, who stood with great aplomb and half bowed as he shook the Eagle's hand, maybe too formal, and the Eagle said,
"We're certainly very glad to have you here."
And Max replied,
"Thank you. I hope I don't disappoint."
I wasn't worried about getting expelled. I wasn't even worried about getting the colonel expelled, though maybe I should have been. I was worried that it wouldn't work because Alaska hadn't planned it. Maybe no prank worthy of her could be pulled off without her.
The eagle stood behind the podium.
"This is a day of historic significance at Culver Creek. It was the vision of our founder, Philip Garden, that you, as students, and we, as faculty, might take one afternoon a year to benefit from the wisdom of voices outside the school, and so we meet here annually to learn from them, to see the world as others see it. Today, our junior class speaker is Dr. William Morse, a professor of psychology at the University of Central Florida and a widely respected scholar. He is here today to talk about teenagers and sexuality, a topic I'm sure you will find considerably interesting. So please help me welcome Dr. Morse to the podium."
We applauded. My heart beat in my chest like it wanted to applaud, too. As Max walked up to the podium, Laura leaned down to me and whispered,
"He is really hot."
"Thank you, Mr. Starnes."
Max smiled and nodded to the eagle, then straightened his papers and placed them on the podium. Even I almost believed he was a professor of psychology. I wondered if maybe he was an actor supplementing his income. He read directly from the speech without looking up, but he read with the confident, airy tone of a slightly snooty academic.
"I'm here today to talk with you about the fascinating subject of teenage sexuality. My research is in the field of sexual linguistics, specifically the way that young people discuss sex and related questions. So, for instance, I'm interested in why my saying the word arm might not make you laugh, but my saying the word vagina might."
And indeed, there were some nervous titters from the audience.
"The way young people speak about one another's bodies says a great deal about our society. In today's world, boys are much more likely to objectify girls' bodies than the other way around. Boys will say amongst themselves that so-and-so has a nice rack, while girls will more likely say that a boy is cute, a term that describes both physical and emotional characteristics. This has the effect of turning girls into mere objects, while boys are seen by girls as whole people."
And then Lara stood up, and in her delicate, innocent accent, cut Dr. William Morse off.
"You're so hot. I wish you'd shut up and take off your clothes."
The students laughed, but all of the teachers turned around and looked at her, stunned, silent. She sat down.
"What's your name, dear?"
"Lara," she said.
"Now, Lara," Max said, looking down at his paper to remember the line, "what we have here is a very interesting case study, a female objectifying me, a male. It's so unusual that I can only assume you're making an attempt at humor."
Lara stood up again and shouted,
"I'm not kidding. Take off your clothes."
He nervously looked down at the paper and then looked up at all of us, smiling.
"Well, it is certainly important to subvert the patriarchal paradigm, and I suppose this is a way." "All right, then," he said, stepping to the left of the podium.
And then he shouted, loud enough that Takumi could hear him upstairs,
"This one's for Alaska Young!"
As the fast-pumping bass of Prince's Get Off started from the loudspeakers, Dr. William Morse grabbed the leg of his pants with one hand and the lapel of his coat with the other, and the Velcro parted and his stage costume came apart, revealing Max with two X's, a stunningly muscular man with an 8-pack in his stomach and bulging pec muscles. And Max stood before us, smiling, wearing only briefs that were surely tidy but not whitey, black leather. His feet in place, Max swayed his arms to the music, and the crowd erupted with laughter and deafening, sustained applause, the largest ovation by a good measure in Speaker Day history. The eagle was up in a flash, and as soon as he stood, Max stopped dancing, but he flexed his pec muscles so that they jumped up and down quickly in time to the music before the eagle, not smiling, but sucking his lips in as if not smiling required effort, indicated with a thumb that Max should go on home. And Max did. My eyes followed Max out the door, and I saw Takumi standing in the doorway, fists raised in the air in triumph, before he ran back upstairs to cut the music. I was glad he'd gotten to see at least a bit of the show. Takumi had plenty of time to get his equipment out, because the laughing and talking went on for several minutes while the eagle kept repeating, "Okay, okay, let's settle down now. Settle down, y'all, let's settle down." The senior class speaker spoke next. He blew. And as we left the gym, non-juniors crowded around us asking, "Was it you?" And I just smiled and said no. For it had not been me, or the Colonel, or Takumi, or Lara, or Longwell Chase, or anyone else in that gym. It had been Alaska's prank, through and through. "The hardest part about pranking," Alaska told me once, "is not being able to confess. But I could confess on her behalf now." And as I slowly made my way out of the gym, I told anyone who would listen, "No, it wasn't us. It was Alaska." The four of us returned to Room 43, aglow in the success of it, convinced that the Creek would never again see such a prank. And it didn't even occur to me that I might get in trouble until the Eagle opened the door to our room and stood above us and shook his head disdainfully. "I know it was y'all," said the Eagle. We looked at him silently. He often bluffed. Maybe he was bluffing. "Don't ever do anything like that again," he said. "But, Lord, subverting the patriarchal paradigm? It's like she wrote the speech." He smiled and closed the door. 114 days after. A week and a half later, I walked back from my afternoon classes, the sun bearing down on my skin in a constant reminder that spring in Alabama had come and gone in a matter of hours, and now, early May, summer had returned for a six-month visit, and I felt the sweat dribble down my back and longed for the bitter winds of January. When I got to my room, I found Takumi sitting on the couch, reading my biography of Tolstoy. Hi, I said. He closed the book and placed it beside him and said,
"January 10th.
"What?" I asked.
"January 10th. That date ring a bell?"
"Yeah, it's the day Alaska died." Technically, she died 3 hours into January 11th, but it was still, to us anyway, Monday night, January 10th.
"Yeah, but something else, Pudge. January 9th. Alaska's mom took her to the zoo?"
"Wait. No, how do you know that?"
"She told us at barn night, remember?"
Of course I didn't remember. If I could remember numbers, I wouldn't be struggling toward a C-plus in pre-calc.
"Holy shit," I said as the Colonel walked in.
"What?" the Colonel asked.
"January 9th, 1997, I told him. "Alaska liked the bears, her mom liked the monkeys."
The Colonel looked at me blankly for a moment and then took off his backpack and slung it across the room in a single motion.
"Holy shit," he said. "Why the hell didn't I think of that?"
Within a minute, the Colonel had the best solution either of us would ever come up with. "Okay, she's sleeping. Jake calls, and she talks to him, and she's doodling. And she looks at her white flower, and, oh God, my mom liked white flowers and put them in my hair when I was little. And then she flips out. She comes back into her room and starts screaming at us that she forgot about her mom, of course. So she takes the flowers, drives off campus on her way to, what?" He looked at me. "What? Her mom's grave?" And I said, "Yeah, probably. Yeah. So she gets into the car, and she just wants to get to her mom's grave. But there's this jackknifed truck, and the cop's there, and she's drunk and pissed off, and she's in a hurry. So she thinks she can squeeze past the cop car, and she's not even thinking straight, but she has to get to her mom, and she thinks she can get past it somehow, and poof." Takumi nods slowly, thinking, and then says, "Or she gets into the car with the flowers, but she's already missed the anniversary. She's probably thinking that she screwed things up with her mom again. First she doesn't call 911, and now she can't even remember the freaking anniversary. And she's furious, and she hates herself, and she decides, that's it, I'm doing it. And she sees the cop car, and there's her chance, and she just floors it." The Colonel reached into his pocket and pulled out a pack of cigarettes, tapping it upside down against the coffee table. "Well," he said, "that clears things up nicely." 118 days after. So we gave up. I'd finally had enough of chasing after a ghost who did not want to be discovered. We'd failed, maybe, but some mysteries aren't meant to be solved.
I still did not know her as I wanted to, but I never could. She made it impossible for me. And the Axicide, the Suident, would never be anything else. And I was left to ask, did I help you toward a fate you didn't want, Alaska, or did I just assist in your willful self-destruction? Because they are different crimes, and I didn't know whether to feel angry at her for making me part of her suicide, or just to feel angry at myself for letting her go. But we knew what could be found out, and in finding it out, she had made us closer. The Colonel and Takumi and me, anyway. And that was it. She didn't leave me enough to discover her, but she left me enough to rediscover the great perhaps.
There's one more thing we should do, the Colonel said, as we played a video game together with the sound on, just the two of us, like in the first days of the investigation.
There's nothing more we can do.
I want to drive through it, he said, like she did.
We couldn't risk leaving campus in the middle of the night like she had, so we left about 12 hours earlier, at 3 in the afternoon, with the Colonel behind the wheel of Takumi's SUV. We asked Lara and Takumi to come along, but they were tired of chasing ghosts, and besides, finals were coming. It was a bright afternoon, and the sun bore down on the asphalt so that the ribbon of road before us quivered with heat. We drove a mile down Highway 119 and then merged onto I-65 northbound, heading toward the accident scene and Vine Station. The Colonel drove fast, and we were quiet, staring straight ahead. I tried to imagine what she might have been thinking, trying again to see through time and space, to get inside her head just for a moment. An ambulance, lights and sirens blaring, sped past us, going in the opposite direction, toward school, and for an instant I felt a nervous excitement and thought, it could be someone I know. I almost wished it was someone I knew, to give new form and depth to the sadness I still felt. The silence broke. Sometimes I liked it, I said. Sometimes I liked it that she was dead.
You mean it felt good?
No, I don't know, it felt pure.
Yeah, he said, dropping his usual eloquence. Yeah, I know, me too. It's natural. I mean, it must be natural.
It always shocked me when I realized that I wasn't the only person in the world who thought and felt such strange and awful things. 5 miles north of school, the Colonel moved into the left lane of the interstate and began to accelerate. I gritted my teeth, and then, before us, broken glass glittered in the blare of the sun like the road was wearing jewelry, and that spot must be the spot. He was still accelerating. I thought, this would not be a bad way to go. I thought, straight and fast. Maybe she just decided at the last second. And poof, we are through the moment of her death. We are driving through the place that she could not drive through, passing onto asphalt she never saw, and we are not dead. We are not dead. We are breathing, and we are crying, and now slowing down and moving back into the right lane. We got off at the next exit, quietly, and switching drivers, we walked in front of the car. We met, and I held him, my hands balled into tight fists around his shoulders, and he wrapped his short arms around me and squeezed tight so that I felt the heaves of his chest as we realized over and over again that we were still alive. I realized it in waves, and we held on to each other, crying, and I thought, God, we must look so lame, but it doesn't much matter when you have just now realized, all the time later, that you are still alive. 119 days after. The Colonel and I threw ourselves into school once we gave up, knowing that we'd need to ace our finals to achieve our GPA goals. I wanted a 3.0, and the Colonel wouldn't settle for even a 3.98. Our room became study central for the four of us, with Takumi and Lara over till all hours of the night talking about the Sound and the Fury and meiosis and the Battle of the Bulge. The Colonel taught us a semester's worth of pre-calc, although he was too good at math to teach it very well. Of course it makes sense. Just trust me, Christ, it's not that hard. And I missed Alaska. And when I could not catch up, I cheated. Takumi and I shared copies of Cliff's notes for Things Fall Apart and A Farewell to Arms.
Those things are just too damn long, he exclaimed at one point.
We didn't talk much, but we didn't need to.
122 days after. A cool breeze had beaten back the onslaught of summer. And on the morning the old man gave us our final exams, he suggested we have class outside. I wondered why we could have an entire class outside when I'd been kicked out of class last semester for merely glancing outside, but the old man wanted to have class outside, so we did. The old man sat in a chair that Kevin Richmond carried out for him, and we sat on the grass, my notebook at first perched awkwardly in my lap and then against the thick green grass, and the bumpy ground did not lend itself to writing, and the gnats hovered. We were too close to the lake for comfortable sitting, really, but the old man seemed happy.
I have here your final exam. Last semester I gave you nearly 2 months to complete your final paper. This time you get 2 weeks.
He paused.
Well, nothing to be done about that, I guess.
He laughed.
To be honest, I just decided once and for all to use this paper topic last night. It rather goes against my nature. Anyway, pass these around.
When the pile came to me, I read the question. How will you personally, ever get out of this labyrinth of suffering? Now that you've wrestled with 3 major religious traditions, apply your newly enlightened mind to Alaska's question. After the exams had been passed out, the old man said,
You need not specifically discuss the perspectives of different religions in your essay, so no research is necessary. Your knowledge, or lack thereof, has been established in the quizzes you've taken this semester. I am interested in how you are able to fit the uncontestable fact of suffering into your understanding of the world, and how you hope to navigate through life in spite of it. Next year, assuming my lungs hold out, we'll study Taoism, Hinduism, and Judaism together.
The old man coughed and then started to laugh, which caused him to cough again.
Lord, maybe I won't last. But about the 3 traditions we've studied this year, I'd like to say one thing. Islam, Christianity, and Buddhism each have founder figures. Muhammad, Jesus, and the Buddha, respectively. And in thinking about these founder figures, I believe we must finally conclude that each brought a message of radical hope. To 7th-century Arabia, Muhammad brought the promise that anyone could find fulfillment and everlasting life through allegiance to the one true God. The Buddha held out hope that suffering could be transcended. Jesus brought the message that the last shall be first, that even the tax collectors and lepers, the outcasts, had cause for hope. And so that is the question I leave you with in this final. What is your cause for hope?
Back at room 43, the colonel was smoking in the room. Even though I still had 1 evening left of washing dishes in the cafeteria to work off my smoking conviction, we didn't much fear the eagle. We had 15 days left, and if we got caught, we'd just have to start senior year with some work hours. So, how will we ever get out of this labyrinth, Colonel? I asked.
If only I knew, he said.
That's probably not going to get you an A.
Also, it doesn't do much to put my soul to rest.
Or hers, I said.
Right.
I'd forgotten about her. He shook his head.
That keeps happening.
Well, you have to write something, I argued.
After all this time, it still seems to me like straight and fast is the only way out. But I choose the labyrinth. The labyrinth blows, but I choose it.
136 days after. 2 weeks later. I still hadn't finished my final for the old man, and the semester was just 24 hours from ending. I was walking home from my final test, a difficult but ultimately, I hoped, successful battle with precalculus that would win me the B- I so richly desired. It was genuinely hot out again, warm like she was, and I felt okay.
Tomorrow my parents would come and load up my stuff, and we'd watch graduation and then go back to Florida. The colonel was going home to his mother to spend the summer watching the soybeans grow, but I could call him long distance, so we'd be in touch plenty. Takumi was going to Japan for the summer, and Lara was again to be driven home via green limo. I was just thinking that it was all right not to know quite where Alaska was, and quite where she was going that night, when I opened the door to my room and noticed a folded slip of paper on the linoleum floor. It was a single piece of lime green stationery. At the top, it read in calligraphy, "From the desk of Takumi Hikohito." Pudge/Colonel, I am sorry that I have not talked to you before. I am not staying for graduation. I leave for Japan tomorrow morning. For a long time, I was mad at you. The way you cut me out of everything hurt me, and so I kept what I knew to myself. But then, even after I wasn't mad anymore, I still didn't say anything, and I don't even really know why. Pudge had that kiss, I guess, and I had this secret. You've mostly figured this out, but the truth is that I saw her that night. I stayed up late with Lara and some people, and then I was falling asleep and I heard her crying outside my back window. It was like 3:15 that morning, maybe, and I walked out there and saw her walking through the soccer field. I tried to talk to her, but she was in a hurry. She told me that her mother was dead 8 years that day and that she always put flowers on her mother's grave on the anniversary, but she forgot that year. She was out there looking for flowers, but it was too early, too wintry. That's how I knew about January 10th. I still have no idea whether it was suicide. She was so sad, and I didn't know what to say or do. I think she counted on me to be the one person who would always say and do the right things to help her, but I couldn't. I just thought she was looking for flowers. I didn't know she was going to go. She was drunk, just trash drunk, and I really didn't think she would drive or anything. I thought she would just cry herself to sleep and then drive to visit her mom the next day or something. She walked away, and then I heard a car start. I don't know what I was thinking. So I let her go, too, and I'm sorry. I know you loved her. It was hard not to. Takumi. I ran out of the room like I'd never smoked a cigarette, like I ran with Takumi on barn night, across the dorm circle to his room, but Takumi was gone. His bunk was bare vinyl, his desk empty, an outline of dust where his stereo had been. He was gone, and I did not have time to tell him what I had just now realized, that I forgave him, and that she forgave us, and that we had to forgive to survive in the labyrinth. There were so many of us who would have to live with things done and things left undone that day, things that did not go right, things that seemed okay at the time because we could not see the future. If only we could see the endless string of consequences that result from our smallest actions. But we can't know better until knowing better is useless. And as I walked back to give Takumi's note to the colonel, I saw that I would never know. I would never know her well enough to know her thoughts in those last minutes, would never know if she left us on purpose. But the not knowing would not keep me from caring, and I would always love Alaska Young, my crooked neighbor, with all my crooked heart. I got back to room 43, but the colonel wasn't home yet, so I left the note on the top bunk and sat down at the computer, and I wrote my way out of the labyrinth like this. Before I got here, I thought for a long time that the way out of the labyrinth was to pretend that it did not exist, to build a small, self-sufficient world in a back corner of the endless maze, and to pretend that I was not lost, but home. But that only led to a lonely life, accompanied only by the last words of the already dead. So I came here, looking for a great perhaps, for real friends, and a more than minor life. And then I screwed up, and the colonel screwed up, and Takumi screwed up, and she slipped through our fingers. And there's no sugarcoating it. She deserved better friends. When she fucked up all those years ago, just a little girl terrified into paralysis, she collapsed into the enigma of herself. And I could have done that, but I saw where it led for her. So I still believe in the great perhaps, and I can believe in it in spite of having lost her. Because I will forget her, yes. That which came together will fall apart imperceptibly slowly, and I will forget. But she will forgive my forgetting, just as I forgive her for forgetting me and the Colonel and everyone but herself and her mom in those last moments she spent as a person. I know now that she forgives me for being dumb and scared and doing the dumb and scared thing. I know she forgives me, just as her mother forgives her. And here's how I know. I thought at first that she was just dead, just darkness, just a body being eaten by bugs. I thought about her a lot like that, as something's meal. What was her? Green eyes, half a smirk, the soft curves of her legs, would soon be nothing, just the bones I never saw. I thought about the slow process of becoming bone, and then fossil, and then coal that will in millions of years be mined by humans of the future, and how they would heat their homes with her, and then she would be smoke, billowing out of a smokestack, coating the atmosphere. I still think that sometimes, think that maybe the afterlife is just something we made up to ease the pain of loss, to make our time in the labyrinth bearable. Maybe she was just matter, and matter gets recycled. But ultimately, I do not believe that she was only matter. The rest of her must be recycled too. I believe now that we are greater than the sum of our parts. If you take Alaska's genetic code, and you add her life experiences, and the relationships she had with people, and then you take the size and shape of her body, you do not get her. There is something else entirely. There is a part of her greater than the sum of her knowable parts. And that part has to go somewhere, because it cannot be destroyed. Although no one will ever accuse me of being much of a science student, one thing I learned from science classes is that energy is never created and never destroyed. And if Alaska took her own life, that is the hope I wish I could have given her. Forgetting her mother, failing her mother and her friends and herself, those are awful things, but she did not need to fold into herself and self-destruct. Those awful things are survivable because we are as indestructible as we believe ourselves to be. When adults say teenagers think they are invincible with that sly, stupid smile on their faces, they don't know how right they are. We need never be hopeless because we can never be irreparably broken. We think that we are invincible because we are. We cannot be born, and we cannot die. Like all energy, we can only change shapes and sizes and manifestations. They forget that when they get old. They get scared of losing and failing. But that part of us greater than the sum of our parts cannot begin and cannot end, and so it cannot fail. So I know she forgives me, just as I forgive her. Thomas Edison's last words were, "It's very beautiful over there." I don't know where there is, but I believe it's somewhere, and I hope it's beautiful. Some last words on last words from the author. Like Pudge Halter, I'm fascinated by last words. For me, it began when I was 12 years old. Reading a history textbook, I came across the dying words of President John Adams. Thomas Jefferson still survives. Incidentally, he didn't. Jefferson had died earlier that same day, July 4, 1826. Jefferson's last words were, "This is the fourth?" I can't say for sure why I remain interested in last words or why I've never stopped looking for them. It is true that I really loved John Adams's last words when I was 12, but I also really loved this girl named Whitney. Most loves don't last. Whitney sure didn't. I can't even remember her last name. But some do. Another thing that I can't say for sure is that all of the last words quoted in this book are definitive. Almost by definition, last words are difficult to verify. Witnesses are emotional, time gets conflated, and the speaker isn't around to clear up any controversy. I've tried to be accurate, but it is not surprising that there is debate over the two central quotes in Looking for Alaska. Simon Bolivar, "How will I ever get out of this labyrinth?" In reality, "How will I ever get out of this labyrinth?" were probably not Simon Bolivar's last words, although he did historically say them. His last words may have been, "Jose, bring the luggage, they do not want us here."
The significant source for How Will I Ever Get Out of This Labyrinth is also Alaska's source, Gabriel Garcia Marquez's The General in His Labyrinth. Francois Rabelais, I Go to Seek a Great Perhaps. Francois Rabelais is credited with 4 alternate sets of last words. The Oxford Book of Death cites his last words as A, I go to seek a great perhaps, B, after receiving extreme unction, I am greasing my boots for the last journey, C, ring down the curtain, the farce is played out, D, wrapping himself in his domino or hooded cloak, Beati qui in domino morientur. The last one, incidentally, is a pun. It means both, blessed are they who die in the Lord, and blessed are they who die wearing a cloak. But because the pun is in Latin, it is now rarely quoted. Anyway, I dismiss D because it's hard to imagine a dying Francois Rabelais having the energy to make a physically demanding pun in Latin. C is the most common citation because it's funny, and everyone's a sucker for funny last words. I still maintain that Rabelais' last words were, I go to seek a great perhaps, partly because Laura Ward's nearly authoritative book, Famous Last Words, agrees with me, and partly because I believe in them. I was born into Bolivar's labyrinth, and so I must believe in the hope of Rabelais' great perhaps. For more information and source notes on other quotes in the book, please visit my website, www.sparksflyup.com. Acknowledgements. First, that this book would have been utterly impossible if not for the extraordinary kindness of my friend, editor, quasi-agent, and mentor, Eileen Cooper. Eileen is like a fairy godmother, only real and also better dressed. Second, that I am amazingly fortunate to have Julie Strauss Gable as my editor at Dutton, and even luckier to have become her friend. Julie is every writer's dream editor, caring, passionate, and inarguably brilliant. This right here, her acknowledgement, is the one thing in the whole book she couldn't edit, and I think we can agree it suffered as a result. Third, that Donna Brooks believed in this story from the beginning and did much to shape it. I am also indebted to Margaret Woollett of Dutton, whose name contains too many consonants, but who is a really top-notch person. And thanks as well to the talented Sarah Shumway, whose careful reading and astute comments were a blessing to me. Fourth, that I am very grateful to my agent, Rosemary Sandberg, who is a tireless advocate for her authors. Also, she's British. She says cheers when she means to say later. How great is that? Fifth, that the comments of my 2 best friends in the entire world, Dean Simakis and Will Hickman, were essential to the writing and revision of this story, and that I, love them. Sixth, that I am indebted to, among many others, Shannon James, roommate, Katie Else, I promised, Hassan Al-Rawas, friend, Braxton Goodrich, cousin, Mike Goodrich, lawyer and also cousin, Daniel Biss, professional mathematician, Jordana Sanieri, friend, Jenny Lawton, long story, David Rojas and Molly Hammond, friends, Bill Ott, role model, Amy Krauss-Rosenthal, got me on the radio, Stephanie Zverin, gave me my first real job, P.F. Kluge, teacher, Diane Martin, teacher, Perry Lentz, teacher, Don Rogan, teacher, Paul McAdam, teacher, I'm a big fan of teachers, Ben Segedin, boss and friend, and the lovely Sarah Urist. Seventh, that I attended high school with a wonderful bunch of people. I would like to particularly thank the indomitable Todd Carty, and also Olga Charney, Sean Titone, Emmett Cloud, Daniel Alacon, Jennifer Jenkins, Chip Duncan, and MLS.
We hope that you have enjoyed our presentation of Looking for Alaska by John Green. Copyright 2006 by John Green. Read by Jeff Woodman. Directed by Laura Grafton. Engineered by Corey Young. Performance copyright 2006 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225. Or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan 49417.